If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to A Life Lived. This is Stephanie Okupniak. I'm working around the clock to bring you the most intimate and incredible stories about some of our favorite icons. I thought you'd enjoy this incredible episode from our archives. Today's episode of A Life Lived has graphic descriptions of violence, drugs, sexual abuse, and suicide. Listener's discretion is advised. If you or someone you know is contemplating suicide, please know you're not alone. You can reach out to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline on their website, or in the UK, to the charity Samaritans.
So I went to London and went to It's a Jungle Out There, which was just this insane show, like I'd never been to before or since. And I immediately called my bureau chief from the hotel that evening and said, we're not just doing a piece on him. We have to put him on the cover. This guy's going to be gigantic. And in my 15 years at Newsweek, we only put one other designer on the cover, and that was Giorgio Armani.
If you saw a man living on welfare, making clothing out of garbage bags and cling film, you wouldn't necessarily think, this guy is going to revolutionize fashion as we know it. You'd wonder why he's rummaging through your garbage. Alexander McQueen wasn't a fashion designer in the traditional sense. He was tormented, frustrated, angry, and hungry to rip the fashion world apart from the inside. He was an artist, and there has never been anyone like him. So it's no surprise that his 1997 show, It's a Jungle Out There, embodied the food chain of the African plains. He wanted people to be frightened they'd be eaten alive. He wanted them to feel exhilarated. Journalist and author of Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano, Dana Thomas, certainly felt both.
This one was about Thompson gazelles and how they are eaten by every animal in the animal kingdom. Basically like this, no one gets out of here alive kind of approach. And he saw it as a metaphor for his life. It's a jungle out there. You're going to get eaten alive if you're not careful. And so he set it down in the Borough Market before the Borough Market was this trendy place with a Whole Foods and food stalls. Then it was still a market where shopkeepers and restaurants would go and get food, like would go and source products like in Covent Garden. So it smelled like sort of rotten vegetables and rotten fruit. And it was under this elevated train line because there's a train station down there. And so there was rumbling overhead and it was dark. It was February. It was raining. It was nasty out and freezing. And then because he had this whole following of St. Martin's kids and the whole sort of crowd from the clubs, because he would go out to raves and he was a club kid, they all came to the show too, and they were standing next to, you know, the team of retailers from Macy's and Saks Fifth Avenue. They were all hopped up on I don't know what, and drinking tequila, because one of McQueen's sponsors was a tequila brand, and they were handing out little bottles of tequila, and everyone was throwing back tequila and getting tanked at 6:30 in the evening. And there was this surge of kids. They surged the venue, and just as the show was kicking off, McQueen had he was also inspired by the movie The Eyes of Laura Mars. And there were crashed cars all over the place. And then he was also inspired by Bonnie and Clyde, the Arthur Penn movie, at the end where everyone is shot like crazy, like by thousands, like a hurricane of bullets. So there was like a gunshot wall of corrugated metal. So it was already looking a little rough and scary, like, where am I? Then this kid, Nick, kicks over this grease pot and then ignites one of the wrecked cars. And I'm thinking, there's probably gas in that car. It could blow up any minute and take out the entire fashion industry. And the models are still going, and there was a blackout, and the music stopped, and this car is on fire. And then out of nowhere, it was a guy from the sound booth, leaps out with a fire extinguisher, stands on the roof of the car with the fire extinguisher, and puts out the fire. And then the show carries on. And I was like, oh my God, what just went down here? And people thought it was part of the show, because that's how theatrical and kind of crazy, okay, really crazy, McQueen was then. You know, he'd had models running down the runway acting as if they'd been raped with blood running down their legs. So that a car catches on fire and somebody puts it out with a fire extinguisher, you go like, oh, right, that's part of the show, right?
Alexander McQueen was a visionary. He didn't know how else to express himself other than making women look intimidatingly beautiful, with stunning silhouettes and outrageous outlines. Fashion was his outlet, but it wasn't always his friend. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. Before Alexander McQueen became globally known, he was born Lee Alexander McQueen. Author of Blood Beneath the Skin, Andrew Wilson, told us a bit more about the couture creator's upbringing.
He was the youngest of six. He was born in 1969 in Lewisham in London. And he came from a very working class family. His dad was a taxi driver. The family were living in this very, very small, cramped house. You know, it was a very, very difficult existence. And Lee, from a very early age, knew he wanted something different. And that's the kind of the great mystery of where that ambition came from, this idea that he was set apart from his family. From a very early age, he was kind of drawing images of big Cinderella dresses on his bedroom wall in crayon. He was looking at his sister's outfits, telling them, you know, this jacket would go better with that skirt, and so on. And he was extraordinarily visual and imaginative. You know, he didn't come from any kind of family that had connections. You know, there were some kind of aunts who worked in the rag trade, but on a kind of a sort of basic sewing level. And when he told his dad that he wanted to go into fashion, his dad said, well, you can get a job on the market stall. That was his father's idea of working in fashion, not becoming creative director of Givenchy and starting his own label. His mum always encouraged him. His mum, Joyce, was a very central figure in his life. So whereas perhaps his father, Ronald, kind of maybe clamped down on his son's possibilities and ambitions, his mum, I think, sort of gave him lots of support and said, you can follow your dreams, you can do whatever you want. I mean, little did she know that he would go on to achieve such great things, but she definitely supported him from a very, very early age.
Lee knew from a very young age he was gay, but it was difficult to discuss in his working class home in Southeast London.
He said later on in life that, you know, he knew that he was gay when he was about 6 years old. He went to Pontins, which is a holiday camp in Britain, kind of, you know, quite affordable, cheap place for working class people to go on holiday. He went to one of these Pontins holiday camps when he was six, and he won the Prince of Pontins, which was a little competition. And he said he wanted the boy who came second to him because he fancied him. And later on, he would sort of come up with these kind of quotes to say that, you know, he went straight from the womb to the gay parade.
Lee was also a very vulnerable and scared child. His sister Janet was married to a highly abusive man who beat her up frequently and publicly. And unbeknownst to the family, he was sexually abusing Lee.
Janet's first husband, Terence, he had started to sexually abuse Lee when he was about 9 or 10 years old. And at the same time this was happening, Terence was also beating up Janet to extraordinarily violent and gruesome. And, you know, Janet told me that she'd lost two babies as a result of the physical violence he inflicted on her. So Lee was watching all this go on at the same time as being sexually abused by the same man. So that had a huge, huge psychological effect on him, as you would expect. This was the kind of the basis for his creativity, because he wanted to protect women and empower women by his clothes. You know, he said, "I want people to be afraid of the women I dress." You know, these kind of outfits were sort of like a form of psychological armor. So when a woman would come into a room, she would feel empowered and she would feel she owned the space. And that was sort of key to wearing a McQueen. But McQueen was very, very aware of the kind of connections between these two things in his life, the kind of sexual abuse that he suffered, the thing he saw his abuser do to his sister, and then his creativity. He sort of talked about them in kind of vague terms throughout his life. He would give hints, and he told various friends he'd been abused. But it wasn't until after he died and when I came to research the book that this became public.
After watching a TV program talking about the lack of apprentices in Savile Row, he knocked on the door of Andrew Shepherd and was let in. He learned from the master tailor how to make clothing fit like a glove. But he didn't leave his cheeky sense of humor at the door. He made claims he would stitch lewd messages in the linings of famous rich men's suits, including royalty.
I think he'd drawn a penis, and also I think he'd written, "I am a" as well. I interviewed McQueen's sister Jackie, and Jackie told me that's exactly the kind of thing he would have done. But I also interviewed the managing director of Anderson Shepherd, who said he recalled all the suits that McQueen had worked on for Prince Charles, and they sort of delicately took them apart, and there was nothing inside. Who to believe, I'm not sure, but I think I kind of believe McQueen. He's the kind of personality that definitely would have done that.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
He was crammed in a small workshop, learning everything from fine cuts to padding lapels. When he was 17, he made skirts for his older sister Janet to wear to work. He used his sisters as models and would experiment with new designs on them. He loved learning the fine craft of tailoring, but this by no means suited his passion for fashion. He needed to move on. He worked for the label Red or Dead, obsessively sewing away, blaring Sinead O'Connor over the speakers. It was here where he learned about the crossover between art, inspiration, and fashion. In 1990, with no money, no connections, support, or resources, he went to Milan and began working as an assistant for fashion designer Romeo Gigli. Romeo would find swear words and messages sewn into the lining of his clothes. He saw Lee's talent, his humor, his drive, and his passion. Lee returned to London and went to the head of the fashion department at St. Martin's College with examples of his clothes, looking for a job.
He sort of stormed into the course director's office and flung down a pile of clothes that he'd made. He was taken on late there, but, you know, Bobby Hilson recognized his qualities of his talent and his tailoring. But as soon as he started, he realized that, you know, it was a place full of misfits, and it was the one place he'd immediately felt at home.
She had no positions, but recommended he attend the fashion course. He told his family, and his aunt agreed to fund his tuition. He soaked up the artistic surroundings like a sponge. He read classic books like Perfume, which inspired his pieces. In 1992, his degree show was his unveiling. The collection was influenced by Jack the Ripper, the strength and vulnerability of women, beauty, violence, the East End, blood, and passion. It was here where Isabella Blow discovered Lee.
That was extraordinarily provocative. It didn't win the first prize, but, you know, it got the attention, of course, of Isabella Blow, who was in the audience that day. And she recognized straight away the kind of the strength of his tailoring, this kind of sense of tradition, which obviously came from his Savile Row days. But aligned with that was the dark underside, you know, his kind of subversive streak, which was always kind of on the edge. So it's these two things of tradition and subversion working together. And she recognized that straight away. And she said, you know, when she saw the clothes coming down the catwalk, she said they flew like birds. And, you know, this kind of idea that there was a kind of a hawk-like quality to them. So something beautiful, like a beautiful feather. But also she could recognize there was a savagery there as well. And she immediately got in contact with McQueen through his mom. And that was the beginning of a very long professional friendship.
Isabella called Lee's mother 6 to 8 times a day asking for him because she was desperate to buy his clothes. Isabella became a mentor and guide to Lee, but they also became great friends. They both shared a love for the avant-garde and hated the bourgeois scene fashion had become. They had come from tormented pasts, had dirty senses of humor, and didn't take life that seriously. They were made for each other. They were soulmates.
I mean, they're almost twins, if you like. I mean, they found so many things in common with each other, even though they were so different. I mean, obviously, Isabella comes from an aristocratic background. You know, she comes from the great and the good. She was working on American Vogue when she was really young, and she came back to England and started to work for British Vogue. And that's when she spotted McQueen at the St. Martin's show that day. And immediately she took him under her wing. She started to promote him. She got his work in British Vogue really early on. She commissioned him. She bought a lot of his pieces. And she served as his kind of mentor and PR agent and rolled into one. So she introduced him to lots of influential people. And she really got his career off the ground. I mean, she said she was the one responsible for coming up with his name, Alexander McQueen, because obviously his name that he went by with his friends was Lee. But she used his other name because she said it was kind of had a bit more kind of gravitas that the fashion crowd would appreciate. But obviously, you know, it was a friendship bound by also by kind of a love of darkness, but also this kind of love of sort of quite crude humor as well. You know, they would cackle together and swear and talk about their sex lives in great detail. So, you know, they had an extraordinarily deep bond.
Alexander McQueen and Isabella Blow were like a sexless married couple. They were more than friends. They were companions. They had a relationship that was so tight. They really understood each other in a nice way. But that's why when it went bad, it went really bad, like a marriage can go really bad. That, you know, there was contempt and there was, they wounded each other.
Alexander's early collections, Bluebird Garage and Highland Rape, were put together on a wing and a prayer.
He was sometimes used to using things like cling film, which is more or less free, to make outfits, especially in his early collection. I mean, if you look at something like Nihilism, which was held, I think, in 93 at the Bluebird Garage in London, you know, that's really very, very kind of scanty outfits, bits of cling film, bits of cotton, bits of recycled stuff. So he wasn't, you know, using anything particularly fancy. He wasn't spending any money. He got friends to do all the production on the catwalks for nothing. He hired really, really cheap spaces. He didn't pay anyone. And it was all about the creativity. And it's extraordinary, particularly that show, you know, that sort of prompted, I think, the headline, McQueen's Theatre of Cruelty. It had a whole page coverage in The Independent the next day. So there was something very provocative that fashion critics knew was going on here. And he was very clever that he knew, I think, very early on that to become successful, he had to become headline grabbing. So he had to get the attention of the press. So he knew how to kind of stoke the fears and the vulnerabilities and the anxieties of the British public.
He began to learn more about the McQueen clan in Scotland and the genocide that occurred during the British invasion. He drew inspiration from this and created Highland Rape. It opened the curtain on his dark side and allowed an outlet for inner turmoil.
His work is all about the introduction of the Gothic into fashion, how sex and death are expressed through fashion and imagery. I mean, one of the critics said, you know, he sewed anger into his clothes. And you could sense that. You could sense the danger, the death, the decadence, something very, very strange and visceral. But also, they were beautiful. When that show was seen by the media, there was obviously a great deal of controversy because people misunderstood it, because one, they took it as a sort of literal rape, which was not the case at all. McQueen was more interested in the kind of the metaphorical rape of the kind of what had been going on in Scotland, you know, the Highland clearances and the sort of conflict between the English and the Scottish. But then on a kind of a personal note, you know, there were sort of women who were going down the catwalk. Somebody sort of said, you know, there was a woman who was wearing, you know, a tampon could be seen. And again, that was completely wrong. And there was a great deal of accusations of misogyny leveled against McQueen when he was alive. He was sort of named as the designer who hated women, which could not be further from the truth.
Lee had no studio, no funding, no backers or security. His pieces and shows were possible because of the favors he asked of his friends. He was able to afford making his collections by spending his welfare check on materials and recruiting his friends to sew 16 hours a day. Lee loved the underground 90s clubbing scene. Back then, people would make clothes from found items just to wear on a night out. There would be plastic, rubber, outrageous colors and shapes, and this provided an outlet and expression for people who couldn't be themselves in public. He drew inspiration from it for his work, from these raucous nights out, and from artists and exhibitions he admired.
He went to exhibitions. He saw contemporary artists. He very early on started to buy contemporary art. So, you know, he collected the Chapman Brothers. He collected Tracy Emin. He loved Ouija, the New York photographer. He collected images, very disturbing images of people with their faces blown off, and the darker the better. So from the beginning, he understood and he sort of tapped into the zeitgeist of what was happening in mid-90s London. It was all about, you know, the body, darkness, savagery, blood, bodily fluids. You know, one of the early catwalk shows, he wanted to call golden piss or golden showers, actually, because he had this effect that he had rain coming down and he wanted it to look like, you know, piss coming down from the ceiling. American Express was sponsoring this and they objected to it being called golden showers. So he changed it to Untitled. But when you watch the show, you're in no uncertain terms of what is actually happening there.
Lee was beginning to gain traction in the fashion world. He didn't care about the mixed reviews. He just wanted people to have an emotional response to his shows and his clothing. He was closing London Fashion Week, showing clothing that would cost less than £10 to produce. But he didn't even have £5 for dinner. The press began to personally attack him as well, for his appearance and upbringing. They described him as dopey and looking like a skinhead.
There was criticism about his weight, his teeth, the way he looked, the way he spoke. And this was sort of from a very kind of image-obsessed fashion press. So that was one thing. And the other thing was the way that when he was starting out, lots of the established fashion press refused to cover him because they just thought he wasn't somebody, wasn't already sort of belonging to kind of that set of accepted norms. You know, his way through the beginnings of his career was very sort of unconventional.
He was constantly working. Sketching pieces and ripping fabric, he poured his soul into every stitch, every lining, and would disappear from the rest of the world. Author Dana Thomas recalls his drive and ingenuity to get his label up and running.
He would borrow money from anybody he could find. He would buy fabric from street carts for $2 a meter. He was spray painting things instead of doing fancy treatments. He just went to like a hardware store and bought car spray paint. You know, he used plastic flowers because that's all he had and he found. He would use found materials in the streets. He was barely holding it together. He didn't really like the idea of creating these babies to sell. He just had something he had to get out of himself. He had to just express himself. He really was an artist. People say, you know, there's no art in fashion, but there are artists in fashion. And McQueen really was an artist in fashion. And I feel like it was more about making noise than making money.
Coming up, we'll find out how Paris fashion house Givenchy would make and break the fashion visionary. In the late 90s, the face of fashion was changing. Larger corporations were buying smaller fashion houses like Givenchy and Dior. They took huge risks, hiring fashion designers like John Galliano to be their artistic directors. John's work was striking, risky, and his shows were more like operas than the traditional style. As this evolution took place, Givenchy looked at McQueen as the key to their transition and invited him to work for them.
I think he said, shoot me if I ever make clothes for a place like this. And then he gets that job. But one of the reasons he got that job and he took the job was because it would give him money to then underwrite his own company and do what he wanted to do with it and give him the freedom and not be scraping around looking for sponsors like tequila companies.
McQueen took a team of his best friends and colleagues and moved to Paris. Sarah Burton started as an intern with McQueen in Paris and would later take over the brand. And though Isabella played an integral role in promoting Alexander, he did not invite her to join him.
She was crackers. We loved Isabella. Everyone loved Isabella, but she was crackers. And that was part of why she was so wonderful. That was a lot of why she was so wonderful. But Alexander quickly saw that having her at the couture house would have really destabilized those French executives a lot. They would have been like, who is this, you know, Bats woman in her crazy hats and bin liner coats, you know, wandering the halls telling everyone what to do? He knew that that was going to just bring more stress to the situation that he was already finding stressful. It was already overwhelming. He needed steady hands and calming presences, and she wasn't that. But I think he knew that it was hard to just get Isabella to come in for a day or two. You know, she would have wanted to be there all the time. So he had to cut her hard. And it was really brutal. And there are a lot of people in the fashion industry who never forgave him for that because she'd been such a champion for so long. And he showed gigantic, like profound disloyalty when he cut her out.
Givenchy was shocked by this band of wayward artists and tailors. They weren't used to their working practices and methods. Givenchy was very formal and professional, and this spit and grit work ethic was very uncouth to them. McQueen felt he had something to prove, and it was clear in his first collection. No one in the atelier spoke a word of English, and they didn't speak a word of French. But they spoke through the fabric and the craftsmanship. McQueen would insist on treating everyone equally, and their behavior was shocking to the staff. Fashion designers and fashion houses were treated like kings, and McQueen just wanted to collaborate and work with everyone rather than be isolated.
He gave them heart attacks from time to time. One time at Givenchy, he was working on a evening gown that had been completely embroidered by Lesage. Hundreds of hours of embroidery. And he kept looking at it, looking at it, going, no, it's not right, it's not right. And he had the heads of the atelier with him, and he took the scissors from one of them, and he cut the dress off at the knees, just above the knee. And, like, 40,000 euros worth of embroidery just fell to the floor. And he's like, right, now it's right. And everyone looked at, in the room, looked at the dress, and they're like, he's right, now it's right. So I don't think Mr. Hubert de Givenchy ever took the scissors and cut up a dress himself. So he would give them heart attacks, but they also had great respect for him. And he learned from that, and that then took his own company to stratospheric heights.
McQueen had 25 days to make a 55-piece collection. The theme was the Golden Fleece from Jason and the Argonauts. The models would be dressed as a cross between goddesses and warriors. The French were critical because his work was not traditional, but his team stayed true to their roots and style, and McQueen was resilient.
He was this pudgy kid at Givenchy, sitting at Miss Hubert de Givenchy's desk. He had just shaved a mohawk. There was hair all over the formica tabletop. And he was cute and giggly, but he was also rambunctious and angry. It was clear he was angry. He had anger deep inside him about, you know, everything, life, his being. There was an anger, a ball of anger burning in him all the time. Even when he seemed light and happy, the anger was there. It was always there. He was hurt. He was wounded, and you could see that. It was very clear.
He maintained his fashion house in London and would work between the two cities. His brand became his outlet. If the press didn't like his shows in Paris, he'd retreat to London and rebel in his own line. The number 13 collection was Alexander's first incarnation of the professionalism and refinery of his experience in Givenchy and his radical expression in his own pieces. He knew exactly what textures, colors, materials, and silhouettes he wanted to create. He became consumed by the concept of the relationship between man and machine. He had his model walk onto the catwalk in a dress that looked like a blank canvas. She stood on a spinning platform between two robot arms, and she began to spin. As she turned, the robots responded. The three moved melodically to a symphony of string music. It was a dance, and it was organic and eloquent. And as you come to terms with this relationship between the arms and the woman, the arms began to spray black and yellow paint onto the fabric. The model embraced this connection, and you watched art in the making. It was beautiful. Alexander's demands were increasing to breaking point, and he compensated by taking copious amounts of drugs. He would get his quote-unquote vitamin C easily, as it was treated more like medication at the time in the fashion world. His relationships were intense and fleeting. His only security and foundation was his work. He started dressing differently. He lost tremendous amounts of weight. He cleaned up, had his teeth fixed, and began dressing in couture. He admitted his transformation was regretful because he felt like he was losing himself.
He developed a bunch of bad habits while he was there. Eventually, that led to his death. Most importantly, his drug addiction. To keep up with the schedule, he started doing cocaine. And that would eventually do him in, made him paranoid, made him crazy. But he didn't really, I mean, he sort of dabbled in it a little tiny bit in the months before the Givenchy job. Honestly, I don't think he could have afforded drugs. He was so broke. But when he got that Givenchy money and he was commuting and he was doing his own collections, Givenchy Haute Couture and Givenchy Women's Wear, he just couldn't keep up. And at the time, cocaine was the drug. It wasn't speed. He wasn't a speed freak. And he also loved the euphoria that it brought to him when he was feeling so tired and run down. And he became a serious cocaine addict very quickly, and he could afford it because he had all this money. So that was also a turning point that was not a good way.
I interviewed one of his boyfriends who told me that at one point, you know, he was spending something like £600 a day on drugs and cocaine, which is extraordinary. And obviously he would be sharing that out with some other people, but with the kind of the drug dependency became, you know, sort of various consequences, such as his mental health deteriorated and his paranoia increased. So there were obviously consequences to taking those drugs.
Lee was breaking down. His 2001 show Voss was his response to the pressure.
He made the great and the good in the fashion world wait for about an hour, looking at themselves reflected in this glass box. So there was this enormous glass box on stage, and everybody had to kind of look at the reflections. And he found that concept, just of fashion people looking at themselves, incredibly amusing, because obviously he had a really dark sense of humour. And then, you know, it went even more kind of extraordinary. So the kind of models would come out, you know, there was Kate Moss there with her head bandaged. And these kind of models looked like they were either, you know, kind of, they'd had some kind of drastic plastic surgery, or they were sort of like in some kind of lunatic asylum. So they're kind of prancing around the stage and clawing at the edges of the box.
The sound of a slowing heartbeat became deafening to the audience. And then, flatline.
He was sort of playing with the concept of what it means to be alive, what it means to be dead, and the possibility of a life after death was very intriguing for him. I think, I'm not quite sure whether he would have been scared of dying in a kind of a conventional sense, because I think, as I said, it was much more open to the possibility that he would have had a different life after this one. And then it's, you know, it went even one step further. So right at the end, there was another kind of glass, another kind of box, which exploded. The kind of sides of the box came down to reveal this overweight naked woman wearing what looked like an old-fashioned gas mask, and there were sort of moths and butterflies all fluttering around her. And he said, McQueen said, you know, that's, that image represented the death of fashion. So McQueen was not afraid at all to provoke even those people that he knew were his greatest supporters. So he had people in the audience who were the editors of Vogue, but he was criticising the industry with these extraordinary images, you know, really kind of biting the hand that feeds him.
Tom Ford felt this show was the perfect reflection of how poetry and art could be married with commerce. And he swept McQueen away from Givenchy and brought him to Gucci.
So I think at that point, you know, there was a turning point, and I think he could have stepped away from fashion. You know, he's always sort of talking about doing something else, retraining or, you know, becoming a film director. At one point, he had a place at the Slade Art School just before he died. You know, he talked about becoming a gay porn director. You know, his dissatisfaction with fashion was sort of there. But when he was offered the deal with Gucci, which was such an extraordinary offer, to get that amount of money and to do that kind of deal, he couldn't resist. And I suppose it's one of those things that, how do you even turn away from that kind of life-changing temptation of a deal?
Alexander only worked for Givenchy for 5 years, but during that time, he created and released 30 collections. In 2003, Alexander McQueen was honored by Queen Elizabeth II with a CBE.
His sort of meeting with the Queen. I mean, I think he'd always thought that he had this idea that the moniker was a really kind of bad thing, but when it came to accepting the CBE and meeting the Queen, his head was turned. There's some kind of a lovely kind of quote where he sort of met the Queen at Buckingham Palace and he sort of like clocks eyes with her. And there's some kind of unconscious silent communication that went on, that he sort of understood what the Queen was all about in that moment.
Alexander and Isabella did make amends, but they were never the soulmates they once were.
They sort of made up and they became better friends again. But there was kind of that black mark that existed over the Givenchy placing. I don't think Isabella really ever forgave McQueen. And then obviously when Isabella suffered from mental health problems and she was diagnosed as being bipolar and she repeatedly tried to kill herself, McQueen paid for some of her treatment at the Priory, which she didn't know about.
Alexander McQueen and Philip Tracy gathered with a few of her friends at her manor home for what they thought was a weekend getaway.
She started to have medication for her bipolar, but that didn't really help. She finally took her own life by drinking a weed killer called Parkrat, which was an incredibly painful and slow death. And that was in May 2007. And I think that experience hit McQueen really, really hard at Isabella's memorial service in Gloucester Cathedral, I think it was. There's a picture of him wearing a kilt, and he looks like a completely broken man. So from that point onwards, McQueen was never the same again.
La Dame Bleue was Philip Tracy and Alexander McQueen's homage to Isabella. The room smelled of her perfume. Her eyes peeked through their hats. Her silhouette could be seen in every stitch, feather, and curve. McQueen struggled terribly with the loss of his soulmate. His show Horn of Plenty portrayed the women with grossly exaggerated lips and restrictive clothing marching around a pile of crap. It's clear his passion was descending into madness. He learned he was HIV positive and became frighteningly skinny.
The idea that death was another possibility was opened with the kind of the HIV status. Today, it's obviously very, very different. But then I think for him, he potentially thought that, you know, he might not have much time left. And with Isabella's suicide, that door was very much open for him. I think he always sort of thought that the barrier between the world of our reality and the next world was very thin for him. You know, he was always interested in this kind of concept of sort of aliens and science fiction and horror and the kind of gossamer thin barrier between the worlds of what we regard as reality and other worlds of reality. So I think he perhaps thought he could step through into a different world.
Plato's Atlantis showed amphibian creatures returning to the sea. His army of underwater Martians wore prosthetics and marched in armadillo heels.
That was an extraordinary and very beautiful, beautiful show. It was something kind of like a fantastical dreamscape. And one of the inspirations for this collection was James Cameron's film, The Abyss. And it was all about the kind of the murky depths of McQueen's subconsciousness, where humans come from, the idea that perhaps we might go back to the sea. So he called it Plato's Atlantis. And he imagined what this new species would look like, sort of untouchable, statuesque women. And they were all wearing these extraordinary dome-shaped, what became as armadillo shoes. They were kind of a reworking of a 1968 design by Alan Jones, which was another one of McQueen's great influences. So there were kind of women walking down the catwalk with these big cloven hooves, but beautiful, extraordinarily high-heeled shoes, something you'd never seen before, wearing jungle prints, new shapes, a thing of beauty, and people reacted so positively towards this collection. You know, it was yet another way that McQueen had pushed the boundaries of fashion, and to do that with each collection was an extraordinary thing.
After a long illness, Alexander's mother, Joyce McQueen, passed away. Lee was inconsolable. On the eve of his mother's funeral, Alexander McQueen committed suicide.
He thought about killing himself in various kind of ways, and there were kind of two overdoses, two cries for help, if you like, in May and July of 2009. And then on the 10th of February, I think he went out for dinner with some people from his studio and then back to his flat, where he died by suicide.
So on Wednesday afternoons in Paris, you take your children to their activities. And so I'd taken my daughter to ballet. And I was being, you know, a ballet mom, sitting at a round table with some other mothers, waiting to pick up my little ballerina in her pink leotard. And on my phone flashed the news from Women's Wear, breaking news, Alexander McQueen is dead. And I was like, what? That's what? What? And then about 5 minutes later, another bulletin flash. Alexander McQueen is dead by suicide. And it was like someone had kicked me in the gut. I don't think I ever knew anyone who had committed suicide before. And it just took the air out of me. And I was sitting there watching all these beautiful little ballerinas flitting around from age 4 to 12 with their ballet buns and their pink tutus. And I was thinking about the pain and the darkness and the misery, the depths of despair that McQueen must have felt. And it was just such an odd feeling in such a pretty and light and hopeful and youthful environment. He had a dark life. He suffered from depression. He was a drug addict. He was a drug addict with drugs that make you crazy paranoid and change, you know, rewire your brain. He suffered from depression. He was bipolar. He was self-medicating both of those with the drugs. He tried several times to go to rehab and it failed. He needed a support system he didn't have. At work, he had a support system for the work, but it actually didn't support him as a person. Plus, he had HIV, so he was taking those meds. So he's self-medicating. He's taking meds for HIV. He's got all these things going on. He has got a schedule that is insane, cannot keep up. All of that contributed to it. But the system failed him. The system failed him when they saw that he was spiraling downward. They didn't step in and say, stop.
He was a radical fashion designer that used his own darkness to explore what it means to be human. Daphne Guinness, you know, she said something to me like, you can't understand his darkness without his light and vice versa. You know, you can't really understand the work without the man. And those two things are very much intertwined. I think he had a bigger cultural influence when it came to expressing these really big themes of sex and death, the twinned themes. I mean, you can't get two bigger themes than sex and death. But he did this in fashion, which was extraordinary. And I think these sort of themes of sex and death have been very much explored in literature and in art. But to do that in fashion was something quite unusual, radical and extraordinary. I think also the investment of his psyche in a very visceral way. You know, like I said, you can almost feel the anger, the pain coming off his designs. So it's very much an autobiographical use of his own life within his art. So exploring this very sort of personal journey that he took through his own psyche and exploration of his own psyche and exploring that through other forms, other media, whether that's contemporary art or literature or poetry. So I think he had an influence within fashion, but also outside of fashion.
He was so fashion forward. He was always the one pushing people to do more. And there's no one there doing that now. And that's why when people say fashion is really boring right now, well, it's really boring because you don't have somebody like Alexander McQueen in there going like, yo, you blokes, let's like, you know, mix this up. Let's put robots on the runway. Let's live stream. Let's digital print craziness. There's nobody doing that. They're all being really safe. They're publicly traded companies. They're afraid to do anything that might make their shares drop. They sell bland, commercially, globally. It all looks great. It makes them pots and pots and pots of money. But it's not terribly interesting. Nothing is terribly interesting now. And that void is what we're seeing because we don't have Alexander McQueen on the scene stirring it up. And I feel like if he had not gone into fashion, if his mother hadn't sent him to Savile Row, and he had managed to get to an art school and studied art pure and simple, he would have been a sculptor, he would have been a photographer, he would have been a multi-genre artist. And he would have been a really brilliant artist. The Picasso of fashion.
Andrew Wilson's book, Blood Beneath the Skin, is available for purchase and download wherever you get your books. Dana Thomas's book, Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano, is a disturbing insider's look into the harsh realities of the fashion world at the time. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. Assistant produced by Paige Waller. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_. If you were affected by anything in this podcast, please know you are not alone. You can reach out to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline in America on their website, or in the UK,